It's time to think big with Big Alaska guests, Big Alaska adventures, and no good line through your tooth, tall Alaska tales. It's the Big Alaska Show. Coming to you from the studios of BigAlaskaShow.com, I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve and some Big Alaska Show friends. We're pulling out golden nuggets from the past as we head towards our Big Alaska Show 15th anniversary. Plus, we have a tall Alaska tale to tell. Designed to raise your spirits and not your blood pressure, unless you're a guy named Mike Ford. Good morning, everybody. It's the Big Alaska Show.
And good morning. Welcome to the Big Alaska Show. My buddy and co-host, Mike Ford, up early in the morning, although it's his day is halfway done.
By the time this thing airs, it's like lunchtime for me.
I know. Mike's got a drive time show Monday through Friday. And at what time does your show start?
6 a.m.
Wow.
I know.
So what time do you have to get up to get there?
Depends on the weather and the dogs. If I roll out about 5, I'm usually good to go.
Okay. So you're right. Your day's halfway done by the time you do our show.
Yeah.
Today's show we call Nuggets because...
Nuggets.
Yes, Nuggets. You've been bugging me all these years. We've got tons of content from previous shows that we should mine some of the nuggets. But the problem is I have the same problem you do, which is just getting back to them and listening to them. So if I've got to go back and listen to them, you have to listen with me.
Fair is fair.
Okay. So what I'm doing is I've grabbed shows we've done in the past. I don't know exactly what's on them. I do, but we're going to listen to them in real time together.
Okay.
And then we'll comment. So how does that sound?
I love it.
But of course, Mike, we'd be remiss if we didn't start the Big Alaska Show out the right way.
Yes. That's improved since we've been Zooming, by the way. The coffee has. We put a mask on it.
Strap on a mask.
Folks, the key to a radio show, especially an early morning radio show, is a strong cup of coffee. And there's nothing stronger than Mike Ford's Big Alaska Show blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning indigestion. Big Alaska Show is a powerful blend made up of the tailings from the broadcast sales department's coffee left on the Bunsen burner from the day before. Big Alaska Show blend is so strong, it'll jumpstart your engine and make unsightly back hair stand on end. And we're talking on the ladies. Some say Anchorage windstorms come from the southeast. Others claim it comes from political talk shows. But we know it comes from Big Alaska Show blend, where one just caffeine-packed sip will take the wind right out of you. Bitter biting with a specific gravity of basalt. Big Alaska Show blend, the intense early morning coffee for intense early morning gas.
So that's how we roll on the Big Alaska Show. So stay tuned for more Big Alaska Show fun and go to BigAlaskaShow.com for our podcasts.
Fogged or broken glass in your windows or doors? Get it replaced fast and save from Neighbors Windows and Doors. Neighbors Windows and Doors manufactures replacement glass right here in Anchorage. That means factory direct savings to you, a quick turnaround, and a lifetime warranty. From now until Christmas, save 20% on all locally manufactured insulated glass. Plus, take 20% off the installation service by an expert technician. Visit NeighborsWindowsAndDoors.com and thank you for buying local.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Neighbors Windows and Doors. They're Alaska's window experts for windows, doors, shower doors, affordable glass replacement. Neighbors Windows and Doors at 6251 Tunnel or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve, along with my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. Our show today, our nuggets, these are pieces and clips of stuff we've done in the past because December 25th, Mike Ford, is going to be the last time we air this show on KFQD because we're going to a whole new format January 15th, 2022 at the Polar Bear Jump Off in Seward, Alaska, where we started 15 years ago, buddy.
In a liquor closet.
The liquor closet, yes. Anyway, and Mike has always bugged me about tapping into some of our old interviews and things we've done in the past. He says, mine those gold nuggets. So I grabbed a couple of things for us, Mike, and let's listen to this and see if you remember what this is.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I am.
Hi, this is Uncle Steve for the Big Alaska Show. We call our show the Big Alaska Show because, well, everything's big in Alaska. The state's big, the mountains, the glaciers, the rivers and streams, the wildlife, all of them big. But to me, the biggest thing about Alaska are Alaskans, whose spirit and stories make this place special. Today's Big Alaska Show features examples of that. Rob Stone and his 15-year-old son, Matthew, appear on a weekly nationally televised outdoor show on Alaska, which you'll be hearing about a little later on in the show. But first, you're about to hear a tale of Gene Moe. In 1998, at the age of 68, Gene was hunting in Kodiak when he was attacked by a Kodiak grizzly. Gene went hand-to-hand combat with a bear with only a small buck knife to defend himself. That, an Alaskan spirit that was bigger than Alaska's outdoors. What is your name?
Gene Moe.
Gene Moe. Now, how long have you been in Alaska?
1948.
Now, where did you come up from?
Minnesota.
Why, was it warmer here?
Well, I had a chance to go for a scholarship for basketball, and I had a chance to go down into Kansas, and I would do that if I could take my traps along and do a little trapping in the wintertime. And I got a picture of Kansas, and there wasn't a single tree there. The next day, I'm 17, the next day I head for Alaska.
Now, what position did you play in basketball?
Well, I was an end in football, and a forward in basketball. It was during part of the Depression, but the schools were so good that they always traveled someplace so we could play basketball and play football. They did very good for the times, as tough as they were, and I'm so thankful that I had a chance to do that in life.
Kansas wasn't the place that you could do traps and stuff.
No,
like that.
Well, there was no trees there. I couldn't even find a river there. So I gave that up real fast because I've been reading books on Alaska ever since I could read, and that's what I wanted to do. And so that's how I headed to Alaska.
So you read something about Alaska, and that got you excited about coming up here.
Well, you have them old stories like Yellow Fang or White Fang or the different hunting stories or the prospectors, and it was just something new I wanted to do because my life is in the woods.
So you grew up being an outdoorsman.
Yeah, we trapped ever since I was 7 years old. I had my own trap line, and then I could buy clothes with the furs that we got, and so my mother trapped a little bit, my dad trapped, and my brothers trapped. We all had trap lines, and that was a way of making some money, and fur prices were pretty good being Depression time. They held up. The fur prices were pretty fair.
Let's talk about what happened in Kodiak. You went to hunting in Kodiak.
Yes, it was the 1st of November in 1999. There was four of us there. My boy was one. It was a beautiful morning. It's real before daylight, but with the snow on top of the mountain, on the water, we went by lots of geese and ducks and a lot of fur seal. They are very tame. They lay upside down. They're the animal that lays on its back and always brings a rock up to break up a crab shell or some very interesting animal. And we go down there, and I'm going to take this one guy with me. He hasn't got a deer yet, and so he's going to walk with me and my boy, and another one went another way. And we had a poor morning in hunting. The wind was kind of a squirrely thing, and he had a hard time to really listen what to do, but he was a fine fellow, but he just didn't want to listen. And that morning he had a chance on two deer, but didn't get them. And we stopped at noon and had lunch and started down the canyon on the other side. And I'd send him down on a trail along a canyon, and I'd swing out and I was going to drive deer back to him. Well, I'd seen three of them on the first one come by, and I got up, back up to him, and he had pulled his ear flappers down, and I said, "Steve, you can't hear when you got your ears up." Well, he says, "I can hear all right." Well, he didn't hear the deer, and it's got to be 2 o'clock, and I wanted to bring one back out to the boat. I swung out the next time, and there was a deer there, and I shot it. We had a deal: if I shoot, you come to the noise, and if you shoot, I'll come to your noise. He didn't come. And then we had an old thing we used to do, my brother and I in Minnesota. We would talk like an owl. We'd hoot like an owl, and the animals never were spooked, but we could communicate. Well, I hooted, he didn't come, and he didn't come. So I have to butcher this deer out. We only 4:30, we got to be on the beach, it's dark. What we do with a deer there, we butcher and take all the meat off the animal, put it on the pack board, and then we can walk out with it instead of dragging the whole deer. And I've been making good time. It took me about 45 minutes. I have everything, the meat laying on a piece of plastic, and I opened up and got the liver and the heart. We usually have that before supper at night in our camp. We fry the liver and the heart, and that's, we tell stories what we seen that day. Well, I had the liver and heart, and I'm in big woods, and I usually drag a deer out into the open where I can see around it in case a bear did come or something. But this was all big timber, virgin timber. So I had the liver in my left hand, I had my knife in the right hand, and all at once a bear about 30 feet come growling and coming at me in full speed. So I threw the liver and heart to the plastic, and I remember saying this, "Lord, please help me, I need help." And about that time the bear was right to me, and my idea was to put the knife down the bear's throat. Bear had his mouth open, and I went right alongside of his mouth and cut part of his side of his hide alongside of it, but I missed his mouth, and he grabbed me right by the shoulder, right by the elbow there, and that was an awful bad feeling, really, that he could pull the meat away from the bone, and I thought probably he'd taken my arm off, and his head was right up against mine, so I got the arm opened, and I reached around the head, and my idea was to get my finger in the bear's eye. I came to the ear, and I pushed my finger way up in that ear and twisted it, and you know what? That bear didn't like that. He growled and pulled away from me, and he went about 12, 15 feet or a little bit farther. He turned around, and if you look at a bear, they've got the most ugly eyes. They got eyes like a pig. They just kind of stare at you. And this time he come again. Now I learned something 52 years before when I was up above Anchorage and up on the mountain there studying about bear. I believe myself that a bear are right pawed, like 90% of the human are right pawed. Now I've watched bear, they'll jump in the water with both front feet to grab a salmon. But if they're picking berries, all the time, they'll push with their left foot and lean on the right paw and his mouth they bring the berries into. So I always see predominantly, and I had remembered that. So when that bear came at me, his right paw is down low, going up and down. So I didn't really watch the bear, but I watched that right paw. When it came, I pulled my head back. The one claw got me in the face and cut my ear in two. And then he hit me and knocked me down. And I had big, heavy boots on, and my legs were right up against my back. When he come to land on me, I kicked out as hard as I could, and I kicked that bear just below the head in the neck, and he flew off sideways. And actually, I got up before the bear got up. And this time he walked again away, and he stood and looked at me, And this time he came, and I knew I had to get inside of him because he tore me up real bad with the other paw on my legs and through my butt there. This time, when he come, I waved my right foot. I was thinking if I could get him to look that way. I looked down on my right arm, and there the knife was still in that hand. And so he came diving for my right leg, and when he got there, I put my arm over his neck, and the right paw came over but couldn't hit me. I got in and close on top, and I took that knife and I jabbed it in his neck, and I pulled it out and I jabbed it. When I got in under by his jaw, I cut a big hole in him, and I just dug it back and forth, and he had a hard time pulling off with only one paw behind me. And when he pulled back, I hit him again with the knife up in the neck, and I must have hit a vertebrae because his neck flew and head flew right towards me and just covered me with blood. So I may have got the jugular vein, I didn't know. But he then pulled away and he went off our little arena where we've been fighting, and then he went in the brush and he came back again. This time his head is cocked real to the right, and the blood is coming out of him, and I'm pretty well spent, and I see the bear is pretty well spent, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and I says, come on, I says, the Lord's on my side. And he made a futile jump, and he had his paws in, and when I hit him with my left paw, and I hit, my left fist hit him right below the eye into the nose. Now, if you know a dog, you can take a 12-inch pencil and hit a dog on the nose and they'll cry. They can't take that. And the bear, I didn't know, but the same thing. I hit that bear so hard he stood right in midair for a while, and when he fell down, the only thing ever moved on him was his head fell into the moss. So I looked at that bear and I wondered if he's dead. Now, usually if I shoot an animal, if I hit the brain or the neck or the backbone, they're dead instantly right there. But I didn't know if I knocked him out or if so I tried to go back to get the gun. Well, the gun was back about 10 feet back, but my right hand is all turned white where I hit that bear, and the right hand wouldn't move, my left hand wouldn't move, my right hand was bad. But I got I had a shell in the gun, and I couldn't hold the gun with the left, but I put my arm out and leaned, and I shot that bear right in the chest. Never nothing. I seen some hair move, but nothing. So then I got the gun to put another shell in, and the meat that's off my right that's down on the wrist gets on top of my breech of my gun, so I have to bring the gun up, and I had a hard time getting another shell in, but I shot him again. Still nothing moved, just the hair. And I remember putting the gun down, and I'm going to walk back. I tell myself, I'm going to walk back and kick that bear. And I had a hard time to walk because where he bit me in the leg, all of my meat was over my knee laying down below. And so I had trouble to get there. But when I got, I just looked up and I says, thank you, Lord. And so I laid down, the bear's laying there, and I laid there. And I said, well, they'll probably find us or something. I laid for a long time, and I said, you know, I may can get out of this thing yet. I may get out. I got up, which was hard to get up. My stuff was coming back. My feeling was coming back in my left hand. The right hand was bleeding pretty heavily through there. And I said, I'm going to try to come out of here. I had some plastic bags in my pack board, and I took the plastic bag and I wrapped it around that meat on my right arm, and I wrapped it and wrapped it. Now my leg, it was bleeding real much, and it was below the knee. It bit me above the knee, and I wrapped a plastic around there, and I had pulled my knife out when I come there because I couldn't get the knife out of my hand before I shot, so I had to put it up in my teeth, pulled my fingers back on my right hand, so the knife fell there, and the knife was there. So I put the knife back in my pocket, and I started down, and that's probably the toughest thing I've ever done. I got into some alders, and if you ever walked in alders in Alaska, that is a hard thing, and that tore the plastic off, and I was thinking to cut the meat off, and I was very fortunate I didn't, but I got off them alders, and I remember laying down two times, and I had a hard time getting up, and everything got dizzy, but I took my left arm, and I pushed some snow up, and I eat some snow, and the dizziness went around. When I got down finally to the beach down there, and I walked around the beach, and I couldn't go any farther, but I knew I was close to where the boat is, because when I ever go into Alaska, I got a mountain or something behind me. I always look to the back where I'm going in at, so when I come out, I can always line up on this certain mountain peak or something. So I said, "Boy, I'm right on here." So I was... When I got within about 200-300 yards of the boat, everything started going around. It was a big flat rock, and I yelled, and Steve was down there, and the other hunter was there. And they heard me, and they come running, and I remember telling Steve, the other one, I says, "Please just take a gun and shoot me." "Well," he says, "I'll tell you what, if you're here in the morning, I'll shoot you." So anyhow, then... We have a deal, when it gets to be 4 o'clock, we always shoot who's on the shore where the boat is, and the person in the woods or up there, they answer with a rifle, so no, it's time to come on. Well, but Tom, he shot, and my boy, I could hear him up on the mountain yet, he shot, and so he came down, and what happened? They were yelling for him to come sooner because I'd been tore up with a bear. So he understood there was a bear between us, so he didn't want to go down right away, and he had a deer on his back too. So we finally got down to it, and my boy never looked at me at all. I laid in the bottom of that boat, and we pushed out, and the water wind had come up, so it was about 3-foot waves, and that one motor wasn't taking that boat, and he tried the other motor, and it started the full first pull, and we went up in where that German couple lived there, and we got out of the wind when we got up that bay, and when we got there, they yelled, and there was three guys that came out of there. Well, they tried to carry me, and that hurt worse than anything, so I said, "Just leave me, and I can make it." And so I remember going around this man's house. It went around the west side and the north side. He had a little porch on the back, and I went through that. I laid down on his living room. What he had there was just plywood. They had just been building their house the last year. We had never went to these German thing because some fishermen said that they weren't good people. So for the last 10 years, we'd never talked to them, whoever went there. But you know, they were the most gracious people I've ever met. She went and got 2 sleeping bags. They wanted to see if they could wrap my arm and my leg up, and she had some ace bandage, and I've done this in construction of all of our years. I always make all of our men go through first aid. And so Tom put my arm together, that meat there, and I remember him laying there, and he pushes the thumb in. A lot of tendons were shredded and stuff, and he tried to line them up, and he wrapped them, and then he'd poke some. Didn't want to touch me at first. And I says, "Carl, you got to help." And so he took the woman's apron and cut it in 8-inch strips, and he took the meat that laid below my knee, and he put back up in there, and he wrapped that them apron rips over my leg. And this German did something that nobody would ever do. He took a chainsaw and cut 2 studs off the house and cut the plywood out and called on his radio phone, and we happened to get a Coast Guard helicopter just going out the ground. It was about 5:30 at night, and they were going on night maneuvers. So they swung, and they only had about 50, 60 miles. So they were there in a short time, landed there, put the stretcher through the hole in the wall, and I got in the stretcher. My boy wanted to go with me, and I said, "Carl, you better stay, because we're responsible to get that hide off that bear, because it ain't bear season." And so he did, and I got on there, and a short trip in there, and the ambulance come there. I remember going in and out of consciousness, and that man standing on his knees behind me kept shaking me, "You're not going no place." He didn't let me ever go under, and so he did that. And I remember in the ambulance they put tubes in me and one thing and another, and we went to a hospital, and it's a brand new hospital down there, a 23 bed hospital I didn't know that was just built. And so I met a doctor there, and he was worked with me 12 hours that night. He sewed over 7 hours, it's sewing up, and I asked him later how many stitches. Well, he said, "We quit at 500. That was just below your hips." And so he never opened up my right arm at all. Everything was good. My wife came down the next day, and I was only there about 8 days, and I never got one bit of infection. I was treated so good.
I remember hearing a song about Davy Crockett killing a bear when he was only 3. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know this. Gene Moe, at 68 years of age, did fight a Kodiak grizzly by hand and won. And that was only 1 in 10 bear encounters Gene would have. We'll save those stories for another time. In the meantime, welcome to the Big Alaska Show.
Oh, man.
Wow. Is that we did that interview over 10 years ago.
Wow.
That's Gene Moe, who was attacked by a Kodiak bear, as you've heard, and this story is remarkable. The knife he used was created by Buck, the company. It was a Buck knife. And when I went and did the interview at his house on this, it's in a glass case and still has the bear fur on it, and it's not a big knife.
No. What amazes me most about, well, there's a couple of things about the story that I find incredible. First of all, it makes me feel wimpy. I get up in the morning and I've got aches and pains at 5 in the morning, I am never going to be complaining again, because this guy,
the way he describes the meat on my leg was laying, you know, his thigh meat lays over his knee, and they pull it back up and they tie it together.
Think about this for a couple minutes. Having the presence of mind to tell his son, "No, you better hang out. We don't want the fish and game people to be ticked off about the bear hide." I'm like, yeah, that would be right on the top of my list of things to deal with, right?
His matter of factness. I mean, you know, it's really interesting to hear it again, because I hear it with all new, fresh ears.
Yeah. Descriptive stuff about, like, having the mountain to his back. If you've ever gone through Alderwood, and that takes me back to when I'm a kid, because going through alders is tough. Just thinking about that and the boat, and having grown up around water and gone around in little dinghies and things when I was a kid, and just knowing when an engine doesn't do what you need it to do because you got 3-foot waves and a wind, a headwind, it's like, oh my God. And then, and he's remembering all this, right? I mean, how is this guy not passing out from loss of blood and everything? It's just amazing.
How far he had to walk. The way he described it reminds me of the movie Fargo.
Yeah.
End of story. You know, what's your name? Gene Moe. You know, I mean, it's real.
And the two other facts that caught me, or that made me really think about how fortunate and the timing of it. The helicopter was just heading out on maneuvers, and the hospital had just been finished. And think about that, two factors right there. Can't even imagine that.
And his description of, it was a 23-room hospital, 23-bed. Gene Moe's not a small guy either. I mean, he's probably about 6'4", but still, and he was a Mason, so he was a strong man, obviously. But 68, anybody taking on a grizzly like that.
And that was his first bear encounter. Now, if that was happening to you, would you be back out where the bears are anymore?
Like they say, a cat won't get back on a hot stove, but it won't get back on a cold one either.
You know, this is the kind of guys that built Alaska. Even the way he was, he was a swell fellow, but he really didn't know what he was doing, and he had his ear flaps down. I'm like, why would you take a yahoo like that out in the wilderness? You know, I would have put his butt in the boat and said, hang out, have a sandwich, and watch the view. We're going to get things done and get out of here, you know?
It's a fantastic, one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, I'm glad you found that one again. That was great.
So Mike and I are doing a thing called Nuggets. We're pulling out shows from the past, interviews from the past, And Mike has always jumped on me saying, hey, we got to mine these gold nuggets. And so I told Mike that, well, you have to listen to him with me as well. So we're just grabbing stuff. We're putting them up and then we're just reminiscing. And here's something that I want to play for you, Mike. This was your little interview with Wally Hickel.
Oh, you found that.
It is just absolutely terrific. So here it goes.
He's been governor twice, interior secretary of the United States. His name is Walter Hickel.
A lot of gentlemen by this time in their life have just are kind of laid back and relaxing, but that you're not slowing down a bit.
You know what keeps you young? Ideas and then making it happen. I couldn't read and had dyslexia real bad back in the 20s. I went to start to school in 1924, and little old town in Clapham, Kansas, about 600 people, and I was a little Catholic school, and they didn't know what it was, but two sisters had taught that couldn't read, and so they read to me 1 hour a day for over 4 years. They read the Old Testament and the New Testament, and I could remember it just like today. And so that's the reason I use a lot of short lines in my thing, because in the Old Testament, everything is short lines. The main idea is knowing what you believe in and just keep talking about that and keep thinking about that. That's what I've always done. And staying young is all in the mind.
Well, and I think you pretty much embody as well that take responsibility for yourself.
That's exactly right. I guess I could tell what I tell young people. Ideas are more powerful than money. And once you have an idea, it never dies. Just keep it going. It might take beyond your own lifetime. I saw what we needed in Alaska for statehood way back in 1952 of the young kid. And they passed a statehood bill that gave us in the House, gave us only 3 million acres of land. Everybody's saying, oh, great, it's great, it's great. I said, it won't work because we're owned in common. And so our resources should be developed for the benefit of the region and its people, and not some leader, some oligarch, or some company. Who owns the ocean? It's the richest heck. Who owns space? Who owns the Arctic, the Antarctic? They're owned in common. And so what we're doing in Alaska is literally, it's changing the world. And Russia is going to try to get as close to an Alaska situation as it can.
Well, thank you for your energies on behalf of all Alaskans, Governor Hickel, and you have a safe journey home from Hawaii.
Thank you, and God bless you, and we'll keep on going.
Wow. I had totally forgotten. That was really, man, thank you for finding that. That's so inspiring.
Wally Hickel was governor of Alaska. He was an amazing Alaskan, a visionary. He got it.
Yeah.
When did you do that interview? Do you remember?
It's been a long time ago because I was doing a health show for KFQD along with the folks that own the Natural Pantry. And one of it was about longevity. And I thought, well, you know, somebody that still has a lot of energy is Wally Hickel. And so I wanted to call and find out what was going on with him. And he was in his 90s when I did that interview.
Wow.
And but you know, it's funny too, because I remember the second time he became governor and I was down covering it for Coastal Television down at the Egan Center for Election Central. So the word comes down and I think he had been actually having a nap prior to coming to the Egan Center. Cause you had all the stations lined up, right? So you had channel 13 and then it was channel 11. And then channel 2 all the way at this end. So he starts out at 13. He still looks a little groggy. Okay. He's, you know, you can tell he's just kind of, it's not bad, but you could tell, I think this guy just woke up. Right. And then he moves down to 11 and he's a little more up to speed. He's getting things going. Maybe somebody had given him a cup of coffee or something. By the time he hits channel 2, if you'd have seen the first interview on 13, you'd say it's two different guys. It was like he was up and running, but man, what a fireball. And I love the fact that he was buried standing up. Did you know that?
That's right.
Yeah.
Cause he wants to talk about that.
Fighting, about fighting for Alaska, because he was like a boxer back in the day. And yeah, but thank you for finding that. That was one of my favorite interviews of all time.
I went to his funeral, and I remember that because his kid talked about the dime or something. He came to Alaska with 22 cents, and so he was buried standing up with 22 cents in his pocket, put in his pocket or something like that. It's,
yeah.
See, this is why we have nuggets. You are such a brilliant guy for suggesting we mine these gold nuggets.
Well, you know, sometimes it just takes a while for people to pay attention to what I say. So,
well really, Amy will agree with you on that. You know, I'm a bonehead. Our next gold nugget. Do you remember David Seward?
He was the mayor of Seward.
He was the mayor of Seward. And I came across this interview with him. His story, this is another remarkable story. This is an interview with David Seward, the mayor of Seward.
My name is David Seward. Currently, I work as a security officer at the port in Anchorage, and I'm also the mayor of Seward. So I have to juggle between my regular work and my mayorship. So it's challenging, and at the same time, it's very rewarding. So it's a balance.
You know, there's not a lot of people I know that are mayors of a town is a part-time job. You have a very unique background because, I mean, you're not from Odessa, Texas.
Oh, no.
Where are you from?
My parents are from Tibet. They're nomadic. So I guess I am by ethnicity Tibetan, born in Kathmandu, Nepal, which is the Himalayas. And so I have that background. Actually, I believe I was born in a tent. So I feel like I'm 100 years old, coming all the way to America, having a vehicle, living in basically 21st century. So that's my background, and between living in a tent and coming to America, it's just, I don't know, I feel like I'm 100 years old.
Are your parents still alive?
No, they're not. They passed away, and I was adopted by an American, she's a female, of course, missionary, who really, she's kind of like a small-time philanthropist, like Mother Teresa. She helps out. She helps out the widows, the orphanages. And that's how she basically came in contact with me, because she was helping out my parents who were having a hard time. As you know, nomads don't have regular jobs. They, especially in Kathmandu, where it's a third world country. So what my parents did was go out and knock on doors and beg for food. And that's how my parents came in contact with my adopted mother. And so eventually my parents passed away.
How old were you when you were adopted?
I was about 4.
Do you remember your parents?
Yes, I do. Very not vividly, but enough to, I can picture their face. I can see their shadows.
So your bloodline then what is Tibetan?
Tibet currently is part of China. However, it depends whose history you listen to, but it used to be an independent country until the Chinese took over. It has 12 tribes, kind of like the Jewish tribe. Mm-hmm. I really don't know how to explain it, except it's mystical. It's people want to go to Tibet.
What is the altitude approximately?
Because
when I think of the Himalayas, I think high country.
Oh, yes. Kathmandu, the city itself, is 6,000 feet, so Tibet is much higher. So I don't know the approximate, but it's high. It's up there.
So if you trained in Tibet, you could actually just run up Mount Marathon and back. It'd be a sprint for you. You could do it one in breath, man.
Well, not really. You know, I've been so accustomed to the American life and just not, you know, I mean, but you're absolutely right. Depending where you were born, I think there's a DNA in you that when you go back to that place of, I don't know.
Your origins.
Origins.
Yeah, yes. I'm with you too. I know exactly what you're talking about. When I come to Alaska, even though I'm originally from Texas, I spent most of my growing up here, and I just sort of feel like I fit. There's a part of me that fits.
Mountains in Seward, as you know, we got ice cap mountains just coming out of the Resurrection Bay. So just seeing those mountains really makes me feel like I'm in the Himalayas. So it makes me feel like I'm home.
So when this woman adopted you, how long before you came to America?
I came to America, I believe, in 1985. That's when I went to elementary school in fifth grade. As you know, my mother is American. She's from California. So she really wanted me to get accustomed to the American way of life. And she basically was preparing me for the future, to come to America, go to college. So I believe it was in 1985. And then in 1994, I came to America for college. But for high school, I went to a boarding school for missionary kids, mm-hmm. or for Americans, Canadians, who would experience the American education. So it was an American school with American
curriculum. Where was that at, David?
That was in Penang, Malaysia.
How many different languages can you speak? Somewhat recognize. How's that?
I could recognize Tibetan, Hindi, that's from India, Nepalese, and probably three. But I'm not fluent, but I can understand.
So when you go there, they expect you to be fluent, and you're going, hey, man, what are you talking about?
Yep, that's correct.
So then where did you go to college?
Well, I came to California. I went to college in Vanguard University. It's in Costa Mesa. However, I was there for a semester. As you know, any young adult, I hung out with the wrong crowd. So it was just a semester. And from then on, it's been a battle trying to just survive life in general.
So have you thought about, you know, after done all these jobs and you become mayor of Seward and stuff, have you thought about going back to school and finishing up?
That is a thought. However, you know, as you know, bills pile up, of course, from my past. You know, you have the credit card charges.
Hey, listen, buddy. It's a necessary initiation to America is acquiring credit card debt when you're young. So we'll remain indentured servants for the rest of our lives, and we have to become productive citizens. So.
Yeah, you're right. Definitely think about further education.
When did you end up coming to Alaska?
I arrived in Seward in May of 2003. I actually surfed the internet before I came to Seward, Alaska. I was in Costa Mesa. I moved up to LA. From LA, I moved up to Santa Monica, and from there, just a job, the prospect of good paying jobs was just, you know, it was out of reach for many of us. So I challenged myself to go to Bellingham, Washington. Actually, I took the Greyhound bus, took one-way ticket all the way north, and we stopped in Bellingham, Washington. So I was there for about 5 years. And in 2003, I arrived in Seward, Alaska, just surfing on the net. I always wanted to come to Alaska. I had a chance, actually, in 1997 to go to Job Corps in Alaska. So anyway, that was my first, actually, thinking about coming to Alaska was in 1997. So eventually, in 2003, I arrived in Seward, Alaska with nothing but a few $100 and a backpack. And
a huge credit card debt hounding you from the lower 48. What do they say? There's two kinds of people, some that are running to something, there's some running from something, and it sounds like you were a little bit of both.
Absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly. There's some that are hiding from their past, and I did have my baggage. At the same time, I also wanted a great future. America is a place to offer that, so I wanted to use that opportunity, and Seward, Alaska was it.
So you came to Seward, Alaska. What kind of job did you get when you first got here?
Growing up, my mom always taught me that work ethics was number one. Wherever you go, make sure you know how to push the broom. So I, you know, since little, I've been work was my, I guess, best attribute. So as soon as I arrived in Seward that day, I went out, and Sea Life Center actually hired me that day as a janitor. And I was thankful. Anytime you have money rolling in, you know.
Here at the Big Alaska Show, we say, money coming in, good. Money going out, bad.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so, yeah, so definitely.
What a cool job, though. I mean, regardless what the job was, what a cool environment to be in. Did you enjoy it?
You know, I came at a great time in May where jobs were bountiful. If you're willing to work, take any job. So, yeah, it was a great experience. I've never worked at Sea Life Center with that environment.
What'd you learn about working with the animals? Well, you know, you're from the West Coast at that point, so you've gotten exposed to sea life and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. As you know, in California, they have SeaWorld and Disneyland, and they promote sea life. So, you know, I mean, I was the janitor, so I didn't have much, but when I did work during the swing shift or midnight shift, I actually had time to just kind of pause and look and just enjoy, you know.
So you're basically saying cleaning up after the animals probably isn't one of the most glamorous job that you might put on the resume. But hey, man, it sounds a lot like all the guys I grew up with. We worked as either box boys or janitors. I worked as a janitor in a doctor's office before school. What we have to do is we have to take a quick break here. But when we come back, I want to talk to you about how you evolved in becoming the mayor of Seward.
Sounds good.
What'd you think about that?
That was, you know, it's funny because you talk about similarities. I mean, you know, Governor Hickel had a little less money, but, you know, they both, he shows, so here, Mr. Seward shows up with just a backpack, you know, and he's willing to work and take whatever. And is thankful and has gratitude.
Yeah, for that. Tibet. This guy, Nepal. What an amazing story. And the other caveat on this is when he ran for office, because he worked at the port in Anchorage, which is about 120 or whatever miles away, he would work there in Anchorage for 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off. And the 2 weeks off, he would go and be mayor. And so he went to the city and said, look, just for salary, just pay me half the mayor's salary because I'm only going to be working.
Well, that's what probably got him the gig.
Well, that's true, I believe, too, because his campaign was Seward for Seward, mayor at half price.
I love it. That fits right with our show perfectly.
Cheap. Stay tuned for more Big Alaska Show fun and go to BigAlaskaShow.com for our podcasts.
This is Mike Ferris, president of Alaska Enterprise Solutions. As more employees work from home, that old throwaway printer might not be cutting it. Instead of a printer from some big box store that breaks after 6 months, talk to us, Alaska Enterprise Solutions. Check out our new line of Xerox home office copiers and printers that come with a maintenance plan. So if they break, we fix them. Let Alaska Enterprise Solutions help keep your home office running and reduce your printing cost. Visit us at AESAlaska.com.
Get high-performance all-side triple-pane windows for the price of double-pane with installation from Neighbors Windows and Doors. Plus, take an additional $100 off installation per window on all new orders. Triple-pane glass is warmer in the winter, cooler in the summer, and makes your house quieter year-round. Winter installation is no problem. Our crews are fast, efficient, and safe. To get a fast remote quote, visit neighborswindowsanddoors.com. And thank you for buying local.
And welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. I'm Mike Ford with Uncle Steve. Our show brought to you in part by Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized sales agent for Xerox in Alaska. Call Mike Ferris or visit him anytime at AESAlaska.com.
Welcome back to the Big Alaska Show. Uncle Steve and my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford. We are listening to various interviews and clips that we've done over these last 15 years as we head towards our 15th anniversary of the Big Alaska Show. And that will be January 15th, 2022, and will be celebrated at the Polar Bear Jump Off in Seward, Alaska for the American Cancer Society, where we started 15 years ago, big buddy.
Hard to believe.
My gosh, it goes by so quickly. This is something we did. Our guest was Jackie Purcell, a very popular meteorologist for Channel 2, the NBC affiliate. So we wanted to do a Tall Alaska Tale that had to do something of a broadcast nature. This is the Tall Alaska Tale that we told. And then afterwards, we're going to play how we were putting it together or trying to put it together.
Tall Alaskan tales, tall Alaskan tales, no good lying through your tooth, tall Alaskan tales.
Okay.
So I ought to be good at this. Yeah.
I don't think you've heard this one yet.
So we're going to play a Tall Alaska Tale, or may not be the truth. You need to determine, is this the truth or a no good lying through your tooth, tall Alaska Tale? Mike?
Women have always held an important role in Alaska's broadcast history. Theda Lee Comstock was one of Anchorage's foremost radio and television personalities from 1962 to 1986. She was creator and hostess to one of the most popular and memorable TV programs, Women's Touch, that aired on daytime on Channel 2. Thousands of local personalities were interviewed promoting their various charities and agendas while preparing their favorite recipes for her audience. Perhaps the most memorable guest was Lance Boyle, a steel worker from Fairbanks who had been that year's Blue Ribbon recipient of the Alaska State Fair Chili Cook-Off. While demonstrating the secret of his award-winning recipe, Theda smelled what she originally thought was a burning high-power electrical cable. Her concern turned to alarm when Theda suspected it was perhaps not a dangerous electrical problem, but Lance, who had spent the day before sampling the Chili Cook-Off competition's recipes. It was confirmed when Lance, who was hard of hearing due to ear damage caused by work, unsuccessfully crop dusted quietly during the show. Is this the truth or no good lying through your tooth, tall Alaska tale?
And if you knew how many times it took him.
So that was our tall Alaska tale. I had written it the night before, and then I came into the studio that next morning with you. And this is early morning, you know, we have to put this thing together and get on the air in just minutes. Yeah. I'd thrown this thing together at the last moment the night before. And so when I was reading this and you were standing next to me,
mm-hmm.
and this is what it sounded like. But perhaps the most memorable guest was Lance Boyle. Perhaps the most memorable guest was Lance Boyle, a steel worker from Fairbanks who had been that year's Blue Ribbon recipient of the Alaska State Fair Chili Cook-Off. Oh, man. While demonstrating the secret of his award-winning recipe, Theda smelled what she originally thought was a burning high-power cable. I'm sorry. Oh, man. I can't even get to my own stuff here. Perhaps the most memorable guest was Lance Boyle, a steel worker from Fairbanks who had been that year's Blue Ribbon recipient of the Alaska State Fair Chili Cook-Off. While demonstrating the secret of his award-winning recipe, Theda smelled what she originally thought was... Theda smelled what she originally thought was burning high-power electrical cable. We just need to hang on to this thing. Oh, man, I'm dying. Oh, boy. Okay, let me do this. I'm going to do this right. Here we go. Hold on to that thing.
It was 26 takes.
And couldn't look at you because you were right next to me because I knew I wouldn't be, and I still could. Anyway,
we got it on and we got it right. I'm very proud of you.
So that's our show. And what did we learn? We learned that my good buddy and co-host Mike Ford is right. Mine those gold nuggets. Those 15 years of interviews we've done at the Big Alaska Show, which reminds us what a remarkable place Alaska is, and even more remarkable, Alaskans, and what a rich history and legacy we have to preserve. And to my baby girl, love you, and Mike Ford, why don't you take us out as you so eloquently do?
All right, Uncle Steve, we want to thank our guests for joining us. We want to thank you for listening, and we want to thank our sponsors, Neighbors Windows and Doors, Alaska's window experts at 6251 Tunnel, or online anytime at neighborswindowsanddoors.com, and Alaska Enterprise Solutions. They're your authorized Xerox sales agent for Alaska. Visit them anytime at aesalaska.com. Remember, if it's Big Alaska guests, Big Alaska adventures, and no good lying through your tooth, tall Alaska tales, it's gotta be the Big Alaska Show. Have a great week, everybody.